Okay. Hi, for those of you who don't know me, my name is Dr. Chaffa. I'm one of the hospitalists. So one thing I want to talk about today was a little bit about Medicare, Medicaid, and how the hospital's reimbursed. I think it's important, one, because we don't get a lot of it in our education or your education, and it's going to impact your, you know, what you do when you go, whether you're become a hospitalist or become a specialist. At the end of it, you're going to have to deal with this, inpatient, outpatient, and you don't get a lot of training in it at all. You don't want a lot of training, but you want some understanding, because it drives a lot of stuff that you're asked to do on the floor, but nobody tells you. Okay? Now, the U.S. people actually know far less about it. Some of the international people actually do much more with it. And at the end, I'll be talking about DRGs. How many of you have heard the word DRG or know what it is? One, so a small portion. Okay? So, briefly, I wanted to talk a little bit about Medicare, Medicaid. You get a little bit in the outpatient setting. Tell you a little bit how hospitals reimbursed. Think about it a little bit from the hospital's perspective. And provide some insight into why you're asked to work with the social worker, or the case manager, or the clinical documentation specialist. There's a lot of detail, and I tried to find the most up-to-date stuff, but it's all sort of hidden. It's hard to find the right person that knows all this, and a lot of it comes from the CMS, or the Centers for Medicaid, Medicare Services website. So Medicare, as you know, established in 1965, covers three primary populations, primarily the elderly, 65 and older, some people with disabilities, and most people that are on hemodialysis. One of the big criteria is you have to be eligible for Social Security, so that's why a lot of our patients don't quite fit in this category. It covers about 47 million people, call it maybe 15% of our population. Most of them are just the elderly. A lot of them, I didn't put citations for a lot of the slides. Most of them come from the Kaiser Family Foundation, which is a great resource for just healthcare policy, Medicaid, Medicare information if you have any interest in that. Now, there are different parts to Medicare, as you heard about. There's Part A, that's what everybody gets. Okay, it's inpatient or SNF. Okay, skilled nursing facility. That's what we're getting reimbursed here, which is what I'm gonna focus on. Physician services is Part B. People have to pay for that. Medicare can administer your program, or they can farm it out to like a HMO to do it for you, and the HMO will sometimes give you sort of more services and play around with your co-pays. That's Medicare Advantage. And Part D is prescription drug benefits. And that's different from your Medicaid patients who get prescription drug coverage as part of Medicaid. Medicaid established at the same time, 1965. Primarily the indigent, based on the poverty level, some relation to that. Poverty level is around 10,000, 11,000 now for a single person. Key thing is it covers prescriptions, and it's administered by the states at the state level. So every state pretty much has it. They can opt in or out, but I think every state has a program. New York's is the most expensive. It covers about 4.7 million individuals, $1 billion alone to administer the program, $1 billion. $46 billion in expenditures. You'll see different numbers, but it's huge. And when you look at state budgets, education, Medicaid are like the top ones. And so who's going to get cut? You hear about it in the news all the time. Education, health benefits. Most expensive program, and I'm sure there are a lot of factors we can think about for that. So when you look at how much do we spend as a country, so this is total federal spending, fiscal year 2010, and just highlighted there, and the exact numbers don't matter. You know, it just depends on who you look at and what frame. It's a huge amount. About 15% for Medicare, 8% for Medicaid. So say 23, 25%, a quarter of our spending goes totally for healthcare. And for all, you know, for the, you know, a lot of the other residents from other countries, it's a huge portion of our spending versus what other countries do. And as you've heard in your other classes, we don't get a lot of bang for that buck. We don't do that much better in healthcare outcomes, but we spend a huge amount. How do we fund these programs? We contribute. There's a contribution from paychecks, 6.2% of Social Security, but I'm talking more about Medicare, and that's 1.45% matched by your employer. So you pay some, employer pays some. Medicaid, again, the states manage it, they pay for it, and the government chips in as well, usually about 50%. And so if it doesn't seem real to you, this is where the funds come. Us. Ah, resonates with you, right? Medical students, this is the resident check. This is their paycheck, okay? kindly given with permission by one of the House staff. Medicare tax, 1.5%. Every paycheck, all the time, you're probably not getting much of that, if anything, back at all. Everybody, if you have any kind of income, probably not the med students, unless you are independently monthly. What about Medicaid? Doesn't have a specific tax, but you pay to the federal government, that goes back to the states. You pay to New York State, goes into the Medicaid budget. Even some of the city tax, which of course is huge here in New York, some of that also goes in. So we are paying for it. And you can feel it, right? All your patients on the floor that have been here months, years, we are paying for it. The homeless, undocumented, all of them. Anytime you hear Medicaid, that's us. All right. Now, where do the Medicare taxes go? Just to let you know, so most of the stuff that comes out of our payroll tax, most of it goes to Part A, which is the inpatient payments, the reimbursement that I want to talk about today. Okay. So, now towards hospital reimbursement, how the hospital gets paid. So, a little digression, because I want you to think a little bit about how to think about how the hospital might think about this. So first, remember, this is a nonprofit hospital. Most of them are nonprofit. It doesn't mean no profit. These are all organizations. They have to meet their costs and expenditures, and so they need revenue. So all the hospitals want to increase their revenue. They are often running in debt, which is fine, but in the long term is unsustainable. Right now, we are just losing money. And HHC is coming down on us to save money wherever we can. It's not rocket science. You either increase the money you bring in or you decrease your costs. It's easier to cut costs. Salaries. They're not cutting my salary, but it's easy to cut salaries, cut things. You guys get paid by HHC with your, as I understand it, with your agreement with the resident union. That might get a little bit tighter as well. You guys have more, you have probably more bargaining power than me, because they can't survive without you. I'm more expendable, actually, you know. But they're looking to increase their revenue. So I think about it as a hotel is the first way to think about it. Hospital, it's a set building. It has a set number of beds. Can't change the number of beds. And you charge people to stay in those beds. Okay? And you can't change the rate either. And so what do you want to do if you're a hotel? You want to maximize your capacity. So what is the hospital always looking at? Census. We love it to be low. They love it to be high. How high? Well, a hotel usually runs at about 90% around there. Why? Because they got to keep a couple beds free. What kind of beds? Got to have a twin bed, got to have a double, a non-smoking for people. Same thing happens to us. We got to have an ISO bed, a telemetry bed. Do we have a STEMI? We have a STEMI bed in the CCU? We try to keep a STEMI bed open?
No.
Okay. Some hospitals, they keep one bed reserved in the CCU for an ST elevation MI, and it's always free. So you want to run close to capacity. And that's how the hotel runs as well. What was the other thing you were thinking of? Yeah, ISO beds, you know, because otherwise they stack up in the ED. Okay, so that's thinking about kind of in a hotel fashion. What's that? Yeah, OR, I mean, there's lots of them. You want to have a couple flexibility, otherwise they all stack up and it's a problem. So, you know, if we were to pay this way, how much do you think it would cost? This is from a couple days ago. If you go to the patient accounts building over in Building 2, they have a board there and say, I have no insurance, I'm a self-pay, and I'm going to pay for my room or my stay. Guess, one day.
$2,000.
Huh?
$2,000.
$5,000.
$5,000.
$3,000. You had something?
Okay,
$2,000. How about an ICU bed?
$9,000.
$15,000. Okay. So this is the rate, okay? If you wanted to go pay for your room, $2,730. Same thing for an ICU, $4,000, and then you add on the labs. And I know this because I've looked at the bills. Now it's okay. I don't know exactly how they calculate that number. It's just kind of an arbitrary number. And I think what they do is they just calculate all of their fixed costs, because what this comprises is the bed, the lighting, the heat, you know, all the fixed stuff. And they just take that aggregate cost, they divide it by the number of beds and days in the hospital, and they just say, well, that seems to be our average cost. Because in the U.S., in contrast to most of the other countries, no one is expected to pay this, all right? Few people actually pay those rates. No one has money to pay $2,700 a night. It doesn't matter. We have no money to pay that. So they get, you go down to the pharmacy, you get a fee scale. It's the same thing here. Anyone want to know how much that gets cut down to? Take a guess.
5%?
Anything else?
$250.
Yeah. A whole admission can cut down to $150. Can you imagine that? How are we supposed to run?
We're paying for $2,700, we're getting $150.
Maybe even the admission. That's just the room.
That's not just the night.
That's just a night here in Jacoby. Five stop or five eight. Okay? Don't tell anyone I said that. But, the fee scale, it may go down to like $150. Okay? So it depends on who's paying. Obviously, you know that. Big three areas, Medicare, Medicaid, private commercial insurance. There's some small other ones like pension plans and stuff, or no insurance. And this is just for your information. We hear about emergency Medicaid, so people don't have insurance. We apply for emergency Medicaid. It doesn't work if you don't have citizenship. If it's active, it's good for 6 months and just acts like Medicaid. And then if they come in again, that's fine. They have Medicaid. They just have to recertify. So you know what happens with a lot of your patients? They just run out. They don't come back. They're lost to follow-up. And then they just have to restart the whole process all over again. Now, the important thing that those people, the patient's account people want us to know, it doesn't mean they get Medicaid, like Medicaid forever. It just means that they're good for 6 months. And they always have to recertify. So what you have in the hospital, right, is you discharge these people really fast. So they may get the process started, and by the time it's of value, they might get rejected. And we got nothing. There's very little left, but there is a charity pool, which HHC has a pool of money, and they dole it out to sort of compensate us a little bit, or charity care, which means we just don't get anything for it. And all the hospitals take some of that. So what's important at a hospital is the payer mix, right? You got to have a good portion of paying patients, or patients you're getting money for, to compensate for the ones that you get nothing for. Now remember, some of the people that we have here, they've been here weeks, months, years. As far as I understand, we don't get paid anything until they leave. Right? Until they leave. So you can imagine, let's not say names, right? They're sitting there the whole time, taking up the bed, taking up the dialysis, and we don't get paid for that until the very end. I want to look into that just to see what we get at the very end. But they don't pay, you can imagine, right? Medicaid's not paying out interim payments every 6 months. They're not doing that, So a little background on insurance coverage, because this is kind of how it was when I was saying pay for the room rate. So 1965, they start this, right? And you've probably heard and you hear a little bit in outpatient setting, but it's always good to hear some more. 65, 1970s, they paid fee for service. They paid you what you charged for. So hospitals and doctors charged more. Doctors in general will do what you incentivize them to do. So whatever you did, you billed for it. You need an echo? Sure. Take an echo. Colonoscopy, lab tests, and you bill for that. So hospitals ran up these huge bills, sent it to Medicare, and they paid it. So during the 70s, healthcare costs are rising, rising, rising. Early 80s. And now, this is everybody, and this is federal policy, so they can't really take it back. And an interesting political thing is, which is more so now than in the past, is the Medicare population is the elderly population. For here, sort of in our democratic country, they are a very big and powerful voting segment. And they love their Medicare. And they will vote down anybody that changes Medicare. You talk to the elderly, they don't want to change it at all. So it's not going anywhere, which is good. I think it's a good program. It's just hard to manage. So costs are rising. Now the U.S., it comes, periodically these healthcare things come to the fore, as it is right now. Healthcare is back sort of on our agenda again. And so the costs are rising, and so it leads to managed care. So this is the 80s now. Two big things happen. One is you get HMOs, managed care, Aetna, Health First, all these places you hear about, which try to cut down costs. And you'll hear about it sometimes in outpatient setting, capitation, X amount of dollars to take care of a patient, but they're not going to pay any more, they're not going to approve things. You guys get stuck with this all the time on your social work rounds or care coordination rounds. So now, I want you to think about a table for four in a restaurant. Okay? So instead of having our X number of beds, right, we have tables in a restaurant. And you have a table of four, and you're trying to figure out, you can kind of estimate how much you're going to get for that table. But a table of four can be very different. It can be two people at the table, three people, but one of them's a baby, or four people, and four people that are eating a whole lot. So you can get a different amount for each, but it's still just your table of four, and that's the amount that you're going to get. And so what they came up with is a system called DRGs, diagnosis-related groups, which I'll tell you how they come to it, but basically you'd get a lump payment for that time. So whatever happens in your restaurant, you've got your table, your people are going to eat, and whatever they eat is whatever they're going to eat. They eat more, you get paid more. They eat less, you get paid less. Okay? Diagnosis-related groups. And so what this does is it takes all the patients, all the diagnoses, and assesses them based upon the resources utilized. Meaning, when they initially developed this, all the hospitals sent like cost data to Medicare, and they came up with a system to sort of figure out how much would an average admission cost. So say the person comes with pneumonia, and they'd say, right, looking at everything, everywhere, the average pneumonia should take you about $5,000 to take care of it. And what they would do is they would lead to a flat fee paid to the hospital. And so they'd say, okay, you've got your hospital, you have a pneumonia patient, here's $5,000, take care of the patient. You know, do whatever you want. Okay, but you got $5,000, we're not paying anymore, whether it's easy or hard or anything. You know. And so that would go for all the DRGs, because some of them are a little more severe, and it ranges everything that people come in the hospital from just a normal birth to cardiac problems to, you know, surgical stuff, which we don't deal with. Okay, so DRG. And to keep it simple, you know, they sort of group things into an amount that was sort of manageable in the hundreds of diagnosis-related groups. This goes back years, trying to figure out a way to associate patients with the resources that they use. Because, you know, you can imagine the data is just immense. Developed in the 60s, they tried in the 70s and the 80s, right? This is the time when we're trying to rein in costs. HMOs come out, managed care comes up, and they say DRG. So they're going to give you an X amount of dollars to take care of your patient. Now, Medicare took this, and they update it yearly, you know, as they get more data from the previous year. But they focus on the elderly. So it's all, Medicare is very elderly focused in terms of what they change. So other systems have come out. So the APDRG system is used by some of the insurance companies to categorize like all the patients, elderly, non-elderly. And then in 2007, right, they come up with something called the MSDRG system, which is a little more severity related. And the APRDRG system is coming in most recently, which is just a little more complex. And I'll talk about that shortly. So it starts with the diagnosis. Okay? Diagnosis field and discharge summary. That diagnosis gets translated into a code. We use it to bill. But you also track things. Who can go through all the data to find out the number of CHF patients there are? No one's going through it. They're pulling it out of the computer based upon a number, based upon what you wrote in the discharge summary. It also depends on the comorbid conditions you write. That's the second line, right? Comorbids. CHF with, you know, uncontrolled diabetes, CKD, whatever they've got. GERD. And it also deals with the stuff you write in your H&P, on your progress notes. So that gets all taken in. And for Medicare, it's based upon the principal diagnosis, additional ones, and procedures as well. That can change a whole lot. And so it's important, because the coder that codes this has to put them in the right order if you've got a whole lot of stuff going on, right? Osteoarthritis is probably not so important, as opposed to other things like hypertension, diabetes, CAD. So the codes are a system called ICD-9. The details are not important. I just want to give you some of the names so that you'll recognize it. They're all categorized into a system called ICD-9, and it's International Classification of Diseases. They update it annually, and it's just like a big book. There's no point for you to learn it, and I'm sorry, I should have brought one from my office. There's no point for you to learn it. It's just too much. You have to take courses in it, and even those people don't know all of it. It's just the book is like yay thick. And it's every possible diagnosis you can think of. It's broken out by organisms, like pneumonia due to Legionella, pneumonia due to strep, pneumonia. It's like in everything you can think of, versus including all of the weird tropical diseases that we in the U.S. generally don't know anything about. There's a new system coming, ICD-10, that's coming up in 2013. I only mention that because by the time you guys are done, you'll be using it, and people will be asking you about it. Not asking you to do anything with it, but they'll be asking you questions which will make more sense later on. Okay, so there's a coding system. It's called ICD-9 or ICD system, and there's a DRG system. So here are some of the DRGs. I just chose some of the common ones. Okay, this is just syncope and collapse. Those are some of the diagnoses that are under it. These are the ICD-9 codes, and that's the DRG. The DRG now, there are about 747. I think that's the current number, spanning everything. Pulmonary problems, you know, renal problems, infectious disease, etc. Here's chest pain. Okay, chest pain, unspecified chest pain, precordial, other, systemic cardiovascular disease. Now, it is missing one common diagnosis that we put under chest pain. Do you know what it is? What's that?
Rule out MI.
Yes. Awesome. Rule out MI. Don't do that. Okay. Rule out MI is a plan. It is not a diagnosis, and it's not a problem. It's a plan of action. So if you put that down in the principal diagnosis, it means nothing, because you didn't find anything, right? We record like positive findings, not negative findings. So rule out ACS, rule out pneumonia. Don't put those down in the diagnosis field. It doesn't count for anything. We get nothing. That's why, you know, that's why people are always on you about this ROMI thing, okay? So some advantage of this, so again, you've got all your admissions, they're categorized into DRGs. It's not precise exactly, but it's a system, and it's something we can all use. You can compare between hospitals, like for my patients with DRG 313, my chest pain patients, I can see how long they stay, complications and stuff. You can compare to other hospitals. There's something called a case mix index, which I'll talk about in just a minute, and it allows the government to reimburse more simply. They don't have to go into great detail. They can let the computer decide, and then they just pay your flat fee. And they're constantly looking for fraud, but on a sort of ongoing basis, they don't have to worry about it. They have a relatively simple way to sort of disperse funds, as opposed to having to go into all the details, prognosis, difficulty of treatment, all the comorbidities that a patient may have. Now, the case mix index was something a lot more from before. And we usually think of it as reflecting the acuity of the patients, the mix of your cases. A higher number meaning more sick patients. But again, the DRG system was designed to assess the resources, the cost of taking care of a patient. So it's actually more, the case mix index is supposed to be more of a measure of the resources consumed by our patients. It's usually on a scale, you know, 1, 0 to 2 is usually an average number. And it's essentially the average DRG weight for all the patients. And I'll show you some of the weights. Okay, and one way they use this is, so we're sitting here and we're sitting next to Weiler and Monty, right? So if my case mix index, which I'll show you later, is 1.4, and theirs is vastly different, something's going wrong. Either our patients are different, or we're documenting incorrectly. And so the hospitals use that to track stuff. It used to be more directly related to reimbursement in the past, but not so much now. So this is Weiler. The 330-127 is our Medicare provider number, just like you'll have an NPI number, and that's the one for Jacoby. This is Monty. So that's us, right? And they're higher, which makes sense. They have a lot more, and you know, they're more tertiary care, more referrals. But they, it's a little weird. It's hard to tease out because it comprises their entire system, which, as much as I can figure out, is Moses North, Weiler, Monty North, was Our Lady of Mercy, which they took over some years ago. Okay. So, and these numbers make a big difference. And the hospital is always looking to see if there's some big discrepancy that we're doing something wrong with. Okay. So back to operating a hospital. Okay. So now, think about the restaurant. Okay. I told you about the DRGs. Now, every table four is not necessary, isn't the same, right? When you go to a restaurant, think yourself from the restaurant owner. As I said, doing different things. Now, what do you do if you're the restaurant owner and they're going to take 5 hours and sit there versus the people that are going to sit for an hour and go home right away? It's not the same. One table could be very easy to take care of. The other table could consume a lot more resources. They could send their food back. They could complain. They could throw the bottle of wine. They could spill stuff. So every case is not the same, which makes sense for us, right? Because every pneumonia, if I said every pneumonia gets paid the same way, that doesn't make sense. Some are easy. Some are just horrible. So there are levels of acuity or severity. And so they developed a system, which I mentioned before, called the MS-DRG system. Okay, medical severity. Now, this to capture some of the severity of illness. And it's used right now. This started in 2007. Just so you know, I'm throwing out these terms fiscal year. You probably won't see it again, but the fiscal year starts in October 1st of the year before. It expanded the number of DRGs from like 500 to 700. And of note, we have three severity levels. Major complications, complications, or no complications. And they're paid the same way. You get more if there are more complications, and less if there are less complications, which makes sense, right? Same thing. Again, not something you want to focus on, since I'm telling you there are 1,600 codes. It's a 50-page PDF file. This is a 93-page PDF file. It's just everything under the sun. There are doctors somewhere out there that are sitting in the locker room coming up with this list. It's nothing for you to know, but there are people that are paid to look at this. There are consulting companies that come to the hospital and they approach and say, hey, we can jazz up your system. We know the deal. We know how this works to help you get more reimbursement. Okay, so there's lots of codes. So for a given code, they'll typically break it out. So these are your pneumonia codes. 193, simple pneumonia with major complications, comorbidities, with a just complications and comorbidities, or nothing. Okay? And again, higher and lower payment depending upon where your patient lies. The differences can be very big. Okay? This is drawn from, I think, hospital.gov. And don't worry about the exact numbers. It's hard to tease out, but this is us, Westchester, St. Barnabas. I just chose things that were nearby. And so if you fall into this DRG for heart failure, CHF exacerbation, plain old CHF exacerbation, nothing going on. From what they're reporting in 2008, 37 Medicare patients is us, and they're reporting that we got paid $1,700 for that median payment. You add some complication or comorbidity, obviously our patients have lots of them, right? It's not too hard. 1,700, 13,000. Major problems, 19,000. Okay? Very easy for it to jump up, which again makes sense of what you're doing in the hospital. But, you know, if you were to document more, it could be easy to obtain more payments. Now, it doesn't sound like much when you read news and you hear about the numbers or just business and stuff. But in hospital terms, that is huge. Thousands of dollars. That's what we're dealing with here. And to make it more real for you, you want to think about all the times you're like, oh, how come we don't have an ultrasound machine? Why don't we have another nurse? Why don't we have another social worker? Each one of those costs anywhere from $50,000 to $100,000. And that's what we're dealing with here. Fives and tens of thousands of dollars. Some of the DRGs are not broken out. Okay? Syncope and chest pain I picked because you see I see them all the time. And chest pain in particular is not broken out, so it doesn't matter. So it doesn't matter what their comorbid conditions are. Okay? If it's just one of your cheap rule-out MIs and nothing else is going on, you get paid the same thing, hemodialysis or not. Some DRGs have a second level, so you know, for a given DRG, you can have one, two, or three levels. Okay, so here are just some of the common ones. Heart failure, high BMI, SIRS, chronic kidney disease, hypertension with kidney disease, any stage, electrolyte problems, you know, renal failure. These are some of the major ones. End-stage renal disease is kind of interesting. We never really get taught it exactly. That's really a government designation. You talk to the kidney doctors, they say stage 5 chronic kidney disease. That's sort of their terminology. The end-stage really comes from the government saying, meaning on dialysis. Not stage 5, but on dialysis. Sepsis of any kind, acute heart failure, pressure ulcers, pneumonia, PE. Okay. You know, and which makes sense, there are more serious complications. Now, how many do you need? So this is important. For Medicare, you only need one. You get one of these, it bumps you up to the next level. You got a major one, that bumps you to the highest level. So if your patient is a hemodialysis patient, that's a major CC being on dialysis and end-stage renal disease. They walk in the door regardless of the cause. They have a major CC. Doesn't matter. Cellulitis, you go from here up to the top level. The only problem is if they come in for something that is like chest pain, you get nothing or no more. because you're taking care of their dialysis. So if your chest pain patient has to sit here 3 days for whatever reason requiring dialysis, we just suck up that cost. Okay, it's just bundled in. So just one, though, for Medicare. So hospitals scrutinize the system to see where they can get more money or where they can do better. Okay, and Medicare monitors the billing. So in particular, acute kidney failure used to be a major comorbidity. Hospitals picked up on that. They documented it more. Medicare paid out more and saw that was happening. And now this year, they downgraded it, so you don't get it. So, right? You can imagine this is a very large issue if you see it, where the government can influence what you kind of do. They can reimburse more or less. And, you know, renal failure obviously is one that you could argue either way. Other things, you know, like septic shock are always going to be a major CC. So, things that don't count in your documentation, CHF, chronic kidney disease, obesity. There is no category for this, so they can't code for it, and we get no extra benefit for that, if that's all we write. Okay? So, let us go back to this list. Why is this list familiar?
Almost all patients have.
Yes, all right, that's true. That's true. Almost all, yeah, we have them all. Why else? In your daily routine interns, why is this list familiar? Nobody? Okay.
It's undocumented this way with this detail.
What's that?
They're not documented with this detail.
Yeah. This is why. You ever get those quadrament interrupts? Doctor, please document this. Oh, look at the smiles, right? Doctor, if you agree with this, look at the BMI. Why do we care about 40? Why not 35? 40, because that's what counts. Not 35, not 39.9. 40. Hyponatremia. If the pressure also was present on admission, please document. These are three people. If you haven't met them yet, sometimes they come on rounds. They are sitting in their offices concurrently going through your charts to make sure we are documenting things. And they focus on things that might obtain more money for us. Not in the sense that we're trying to game the system, but if you're taking care of somebody who also has heart failure, you know, we should be reimbursed more. If we're taking care of our patient who has dialysis, we should get paid more. If it only requires us to document correctly. Look back at the heart failure, okay? See what a big difference it might be? CHF, I told you, was nothing. All you have to write is systolic, and that's something. All you have to write is acute systolic, and that's even more. Now, you're never supposed to make things up, but right, what do we write? CHF exacerbation, whatever diuretics and stuff. If it's an acute exacerbation, all you have to do is write that. You never want to change what you think. It's just one word, changing it one way or the other. Another weird one is anemia. Okay, we write anemia, bleeding, whatever. If it's anemia and it's recent, you should write acute blood loss anemia. That's just the term that they use. But never change the way you feel about the clinical case. But if it's just one word or the other and it still makes sense to you, that can mean a big difference to the hospital. And us as well. Because that's all resources that might get plowed back into us or the program. Okay. So, now the last one. Present on admission. Okay? So these are the clinical documentation specialists. Why do they ask you to document present on admission?
Because you get points deducted as a patient develops a pressure ulcer while he's in the hospital.
Yeah, it's kind of our fault, right? So I'm telling you this now, cut your practice, alright? Things that are present on admission are things that we are treating for the patient. Things that happen during the hospital tend to get viewed as just our fault, you know? And these are called hospital-acquired conditions. That is the term. You're going to hear it again. So as of 2008, they came up with criteria. This is drawn from the legal documents. It's called the Federal Register. Don't go looking for it. It is 50,000 pages. It's like everything that's been going on, every discussion, okay? And the government look at conditions that could be preventable. Which ones? Well, you focus on things that have a lot of cost, that have a lot of volume, things that might change the payment that Medicare gives us, and things that might be prevented. Now, there's a lot of controversy, but because sometimes there's not a lot of evidence and we want to protect our patient, it doesn't matter much to the government. Okay? These are the ones for now, at this moment. I highlighted the ones in red because those are the ones you might see, you know, more in the medical practice. Air embolism, blood incompatibility is more like a surgical thing, right? Pressure ulcers, falls, catheter-associated UTI, manifestations of poor glycemic control. I forget what that is, but I think that's more like DKA, not hyperglycemia, like serious problems. Here are some other ones, foreign objects, surgical stuff. DVT, after a knee replacement or hip replacement. A little while ago, you heard a little more controversy about it because we were hearing that they would not give us anything for DVTs. We're not giving us anything for central eye infections, and everybody was up in arms. So what happens, though, is it's not that we don't get paid for the admission if one of these things happens, okay? If your patient has a fall and they have a fracture, it's not we don't get paid for the admission. We just can't count it as something that made the admission harder or more resources. You just don't get to, you can't count it. And you can imagine a fracture. How many more days is that going to be? You know, pressure ulcer. How many more days? Surgery, you know, all kinds of stuff has a big cost impact. So Medicare thinks they save. They're thinking they're saving about $19 million from doing this and from extra payments they didn't have to make to us. And so it's going to stay. And part of the problem is it might be even more, right? Who's going to cut down the list? They're just going to expand the list, is the concern of the hospital. So one commenter said that, you know, DVT and PE after a procedure, you know, it's unreasonable. We could do all the right things, and you could still have a DVT, right? Even on the floor, we can do everything right, and you can still have it. So that's something up in the air, and is a sort of approach that applies to other areas of this sort of healthcare policy. You know, there's going to be an expected rate, and then whatever your actual rate is, this is the part they're not going to pay for. But you're going to be allowed a certain amount. It's probably where it's going to end up. Okay, and again, the list can be amended. They can change it from year to year, and they do. But the concern is that it's going to become larger and larger. They're just going to expand it. Why wouldn't they? Think of it. Medicare has no incentive to make it smaller. No incentive. So I talked a lot about Medicare. So this is about Medicaid. Okay, Medicaid is for another day. It's a little more complicated. It stands for All Patients Refined, expanded to talk about the Medicaid population, also non-elderly, also since Medicaid is state-run, to focus on the New York population a little bit more. And it has four levels of severity, and it also provides a mortality score, so it can sort of predict mortality. So it's a lot more complex. And in contrast to the DRG system of Medicare, instead of needing just one thing to kick you up to the next level, you need multiple things. And it's not clear what exactly. It's not only how severe the comorbidity is, but it's also the combination of what's present. So, I think I wrote an example. It's a better reflection of your acuity. Because you can have, you know, acute CHF or systolic CHF, but whether that really affects your admission is sort of questionable. But the interplay of factors can be a big deal. So, for example, your patients come in septic all the time. Sirs, I got my UTI, right? Is that a big deal or not? It depends. But you know, if you've got some acidemia, a lactate, or acute renal failure, you are a lot worse and that patient's a lot sicker than just sepsis, okay? So that's what this system is designed for, and that's what Medicaid is employing right now. And it's just too big. No one knows it exactly, and so they require computer systems to figure this out. And that's what the clinical documentation specialists do as well. They go through it and try to figure out sort of things that would alter or change our reimbursement. So how do we get paid? All right. So the hospital has a base payment rate, just like your unit of payment. Standard applies to everybody in the country. You have a labor cost and a non-labor cost. Non-labor cost is the building, fixed costs, beds, energy. Labor costs, you have a wage index because there's regional differences. And the non-labor costs, you have a cost of living adjustment because things get expensive. So this is what it is right now. This is just your base rate, and it gets altered. Okay? It's based upon 1981 costs when this was being piloted that we reported. It gets updated throughout the every year. It's called the hospital market basket. It's kind of like cost of living adjustment. It's the same thing as inflation. When you hear about inflation on the news, the way they do it is there's a basket of goods. It may be right or it may be wrong, Over time, it may not seem so relevant, and you just check it from time to time. And that's the increase that you get. Here, the wage index is 1.31. That's what it's multiplied by. Doesn't mean very much to us, but it is a big multiplier. It's the same as Monty. All the hospitals in the area have the same one. The cost of living adjustment is 2.35%. That's an increase every year on the non-labor costs. Don't worry about it. The details aren't important. But what is important is to obtain that, we have to submit quality data. What is this? You should know it. You get reduced if you don't submit this data to the government. CHF, AMI, pneumonia. So the end of your discharge summary, your heart failure patients. Is your patient on an ACE inhibitor? That's that. Your MI patient. Is this patient on a beta blocker at discharge? This is the quality data the government is gathering. If you don't submit it, they decrease this adjustment by 2%, and that goes for all of your patients for all the year, for the entire year. You can imagine the hospitals are looking at this. There are people whose entire jobs are to somewhat focus on this, and we, right, in our meetings, we sort of go through this, okay? We missed one heart failure patient in 1 month, and that got sort of highlighted in our meeting. Because it's a big deal. However, I don't know because no one could tell me the answer and I couldn't find it. I don't know if we're just supposed to submit the data or if we're supposed to actually have a certain percentage that we reach. I actually think it's just submitting the data. It's something that the government does to incentivize us to submit data so they can start making changes. And you can imagine this could be expanded in the future. This could be used later on to decrease payments even more. Okay, so this is just an example. Regional differences in labor costs. San Francisco is horrible. This is the lowest one I could find, Ohio. And New York is somewhere in the middle. It's averaged out over 3 years. Average. This is for paying for like nursing staff and everything. CBSA is just a regional code. I don't remember what that stands for. So you've got your basic payment, okay? That's multiplied times your DRG. So the DRGs, I told you how to we figured it out. We take all of our data, we give it to another company, they submit it to Medicare. The DRG is given a weight, a multiplier factor, and that's multiplied times your rate, the base rate, okay, which is important because if you kick up your DRG and it's a bigger multiplier, it can make a big difference. This is just a range. Lowest, newborn, 0.16 of that base rate, 1/6, versus the highest one, which is heart transplant, obviously, which is like 26 times the resource consumption. Most of the ones that we deal with are, you know, are somewhere in the middle. 0.5 to 1, 1.5, 2. Okay? But, look at this. You can get a big difference. People come in heart failure all the time. Heart failure, echo, EF of 20%, cardiology gets involved, and maybe they say, let's get a defibrillator placement. So, this multiplier factor is one for your CHF exacerbation. If they get the defibrillator while they are here, it is suddenly this. 5 times the amount. People coming in, they get placed on hemodialysis. That's one payment. You put a fistula in before discharge, and that's a whole different surgical procedure, and it results in a lot more reimbursement for the hospital. Which is not to say that you should be ordering procedures on your patients. Okay, but if you can coordinate it, if you were going to do it anyway, it can be a good thing. And obviously, like the renal doctors, they have long-term access placement before they leave the hospital. The difference can be large. You need to go faster. This is just pneumonia, okay? Simple pneumonia, we don't document very well. 0.7 is our multiplier factor. You make sure to put in something like sepsis, it doubles it. Twice as much money, thousands of dollars, easily. Okay. Hospitals that take care of income patients, more of them, or in some hospitals that serve a huge region, like on the rural areas, they get a dish payment, disproportionate share. And that's just added on. You can add on for indirect medical education. So we get payments because you guys are here. Because there's a thought that, you know, we do extra testing that might be unnecessary. We do labs that might be for academic purposes. So we get extra money for that. That is one reason that they like to have residents here. Second reason is you guys get paid low salaries. And the third thing is that Medicare sends money directly to the program because we have residents here. And it is to the amount of like $2.5 billion, I think, across all the hospitals. But you can imagine, the hospital will take whatever. $500,000, $1 million, they're happy to take that on your behalf. Okay, so it's a big deal. It's all part of this payment. This is also part of the Medicare money that you contribute into comes back to the hospital. There's some new technologies that sometimes they give you extra money for. They're kind of hard to find. And then finally, what about cases that stay for months? Horrible things happen. Those patients, there's an outlier. So if your cost goes too high, then you get a little extra payment to defray that so that you are not, your hospital's not crushed by some horrible case that takes nearly forever. So in summary, the key things that affect you are the base rate times the DRG, right? It's a multiplier, and that's why there's so much emphasis on this. A few words can increase your multiplier, and it multiplies across everything. A couple extra payments depending on what happens. I believe we get a DSH payment. I think we take care of about 20-25% indigent people in this area, the way they calculate it. Indirect medical education because you're here. Okay, so the last analogy, I talked about a hotel and talked about a restaurant, okay? So I covered how we get paid. And so back to the restaurant idea, I'd like you to think about, what if it's a fixed price buffet, right? The DRG, you get X amount of dollars. So if you're in a buffet, you pay $9.95 to go in, you can eat whatever you want. So how do they increase their revenue?
Ship them out quicker.
Yeah, okay. You've been to a buffet. They aren't getting any more money from you. We aren't getting any more for the patient that stays 1 day, 3 days, 5 days, 7 days. So there's a lot of emphasis on decreasing your length of stay. Our patient that stays for months or years, well, that's fine. They don't cost a whole lot. But I'm missing out on all the people I could be taking care of in that bed, right? And so you try to decrease the length of stay. And that is why you're asked to work with the case manager and the social worker every day. One, it's good for your patients, right? Get them home quicker, coordinate services for them, but it's also to keep an eye on us so that we aren't keeping patients longer. Us for not to run into problems on Friday, going into the weekend and the holiday. Yes, we need more social workers and case managers, but that's why you are put together, is to acquire and coordinate medical care and to get people home faster. All right. So, don'ts. Don't try to game the system, okay? Do not try to falsify your documentation to make things better, to get more money for the hospital. Don't try to order more procedures. Please don't go telling people, I told you it's all just a buffet here, okay? And that's it's a very simplified version. But it's a way for you to think about how, this is how the hospital thinks. Years ago, length of stay was a very big deal. Now it's just a way of tracking. Because if I'm sitting there, and my patients compared to the other doctors, if my patients are here longer, people are going to start looking at me. Say, what's going on? What's he doing? Is he keeping them longer? Is he doesn't know what's going on? It's for me now, and it's for you in the future. Okay? And, you know, there's some give and take because I cover for you, you cover for me. Some things you just can't help, right, when you get those regulars that come in for, you know, weeks at a time. But these numbers are getting tracked. They pull it out of the computer, and they just track it all the time. Every month, we get a list of our numbers. Okay? And it's something they're following because the hospital, again, is losing money. And so they're always pushing for this. Dues, treat your patient first. This goes for anything. Medical, legal problems, finances, you treat the patient right, the way you would do appropriately, and you'll be fine. Don't even worry about all this stuff, just treat them fine. But document accurately and specifically so that we can be reimbursed appropriately. It does not take much. As I said, don't change what you think. But if it's just one word and you agree with it, that's fine. And when these guys send you your email, these emails and stuff, if you disagree, disagree. Just say no. Kick it up to the attendant. Do not just write it because they said, you know, please write this in. You're like, write it and you'll be done. If you don't, if it doesn't make sense, don't do it. They're not doctors. Their name is not on the chart. So it doesn't matter. I disagree with them all the time. This is why that we're asked to work with them. This is why they are behind the scenes as well. And this is what the hospital is functioning in, and you guys are going to be in the future whenever you end up in practice. And as I know for some of the international people, it's in play even more so in other countries as well, so you may be familiar with it. Okay, on time. Any questions? All right, thanks.
Thank you.